بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. Today we are going to study the fourth lesson of the book regarding technical meanings of philosophy and science. As you remember, we said that in the course of history there have been some changes in the meaning of philosophy. In the past, in the time of Socrates, the term philosophy used to mean any sort of human knowledge. The only exception was conventional knowledge like grammar or vocabulary. But other than that, mathematics, music, economics, politics, natural sciences, all were included in the concept of philosophy. And you remember that we said philosophy was divided into the theoretical and the practical ones, and then each had three sub-branches. Then there was a period in the medieval ages that philosophy was even applied to conventional sciences and included grammar and rhetorics and vocabulary. But later in the West, in Europe, especially after Auguste Comte and the positivist philosophy, the term philosophy was limited to sciences which are not experimental, the sciences which have not used the scientific method in their investigation and in their studies of their subjects. And it got a negative meaning. So whenever they say science, they mean modern sciences, experimental sciences which are positive. And when they say philosophy, they mean something which is not scientific. And even in the time of logical positivism, they said that metaphysical and theological propositions make no sense. They are meaningless, they have no meaning. And this was perhaps the worst thing that could be imagined regarding philosophy. They didn't say that these are not true, these are false. They said these are meaningless. Anyway, because of this change in the meaning of the term philosophy, lesson 4 is designed by the author to discuss a very important issue in our philosophical investigation. And that is to always make sure that we have a proper and an appropriate understanding of the terms and concepts involved in our discussion. So before starting any argumentation, before accepting or rejecting any philosophical proposition, we must first make sure that we have fully grasped the concepts which are involved. And this is why some great philosophers like Ibn Sina, they always had this policy in their philosophical studies, that first of all we must clarify the concepts, we must clarify the terms, and then we must discuss. This is what is today known as conceptual clarification, which is very important, and this is the first stage in any investigation. For example, just to give you some idea, the author mentions a very well-known term in Islamic literature, and that is the term Jabr. This is just one example to show you how a single term may have different meanings. This is what we call it equivocation, which means a term, similar term, has different meanings. This is just opposite univocation. So univocation, you have one term, one meaning, maybe different instances, like man. The term man is univocal. It's what we call it in Islamic principles of jurisprudence and also in logic, al-mushtarakul ma'navi. Means you have one concept, general concept, which applies to different individuals, like man. Man is applicable to this man or that man. But only one term, one meaning. But we have equivocal terms. One term, but different meanings. For example, in English, the term spring has different meanings. All are spelled and pronounced in the same way, but their meanings are different. Spring may be considered as a season, may be considered as a source for water, or as something melt and cast from iron to be used in, for example, watch or machineries and other things, which has a special elastic quality and other meanings. So these terms, which are univocal and equivocal, must be distinguished before any investigation. Okay, now let's go to the example given by the author. We have the term jabr, which is equivocal. It means that one single term has different meanings. For example, when we look at the Arabic dictionaries, we find that first of all the term jabr meant to compensate, to remove deficiencies. This is what we have in also Farsi, jubran, which means to compensate. So whenever there is a problem and you solve the problem, you remove deficiencies, this is called literally jabr. Similar to this meaning is bone setting. If someone's bones are broken and a physician or any other person tries to set the bones again, this is also called jabr. In our Islamic prayers, we have this way of addressing God as Ya Jabir al-Azm al-Kasir. Those whose hearts are broken, who have many problems, who have lots of difficulties, they address God as the one who compensates and who sets the broken bones, meaning that giving a new life, new energy, new strength, making everything in its proper order, removing deficiencies. It does not necessarily mean that there must be a bone which is broken and then God fixes that bone for us. When we address God, Ya Jabir al-Azm al-Kasir, we mean this, that He is the one that compensates, removes the problems and deficiencies, and so on and so forth. Anyway, so a literal meaning of the term jabr was bone setting. The author says we don't know exactly whether bone setting was first and originally the meaning of the term jabr, or to compensate. Maybe it was first bone setting and then it was generalized to any sort of compensate and removing deficiencies. Maybe vice versa, but he is prefers the second meaning, that is bone setting, to be the original meaning. Anyway, another meaning of the term jabr in Arabic was to force, to put under pressure. So for example, if you wanted to make sure that something is certainly done by, for example, a person who is your employee or is inferior to you, or your, for example, child or your friend, anyone. Or, for example, a ruler, a king, a president who was using some force to make sure that certain thing is certainly done. This was called jabr. Means to force, to put under pressure. Of course, first of all, again, this was used for physical force. Like, for example, beating someone or imprisoning someone or threatening someone to be killed. But later it was also inclusive of using mental or psychological force. Even it was more generalized, and it was used when someone had a feeling of pressure. For this also the term jabr was used. So maybe there is no other person forcing us, but if we feel that we must do something, this was also sometimes called jabr. Like, for example, if someone was ill and needed money, and the only way to secure money was to sell his property, his house. So this was also called a jabr. Although there is no one to pressurize him, but he feels that he is under pressure to do something to secure money for himself or for someone dear to him. Anyway, these are all different meanings of the term jabr in Arabic. But not only these literal meanings were used in Arabic, there have always been also some technical meanings for the term jabr, especially in the Islamic era. For example, in mathematics, Muslim mathematicians called a special branch of mathematics in which letters are used instead of numericals. They call it jabr, which is also now known in the West, algebra. They have used the same word which was used by Muslims, because this was originally developed by Muslim mathematicians like Khwarizmi. So here you see that the term which was originally for setting bones or for compensation is now used for a branch of mathematics, algebra. Of course, there is a link, there is a relation. For example, because the negative figures may be considered as compensating positive figures, and vice versa. So in an equation, when you have, for example, positive A and negative A minus A, so these two compensate each other and neutralize each other. Or the other reason may be that, for example, when you have an equation and you have an unknown letter, unknown quantity, and on the other side of the equation you have a known quantity, so you can compensate the unknown by using the known quantity. So you can understand that this unknown quantity was equal to certain figure. For example, if you have, for example, the equation that 2a is equal to 4, so you understand that a is equal to 2. Or 2a is equal to 6, you understand that a is equal to 3. So this is a sort of compensation. So there is a link, there is a similarity, but the meaning is totally different. Now you are using the term jabr for a discipline, for a branch of mathematics. Or in psychology and also in theology and law and morality, you have another meaning for the term jabr, and that is something opposite to free will. So when they say this person is majbur, means this person is forced to the extent that he has no choice. It's different from being forced by someone as a matter of threat. If someone threatens you and say that, for example, if you don't do this, I will imprison you or I will kill you, you are still free. You are under pressure, but philosophically you are free. You may obey or you may disobey. Okay? But when someone is majbur, is determined, in the philosophical sense, it means that he has no choice. He cannot resist. If we believe in determinism, if we believe in Jabr, as some people did among Muslim theologians, there were some people who believed in determinism, and also in other cultures, among other religious theologians, there were always some people who believed in Jabr, in determinism. They were saying that all our acts are created by God, but they meant it in the wrong way. They were saying that we have no choice, we have no freedom of choice, and whatever we do, we are just some subjects for manifestation of God's creation. So if I say something, if I go somewhere, if I write something, you know, if I do something, all are not decided by me. They were all pre-decided by God the Almighty. Okay, so this is another meaning of the term Jabr. This was just to give an example that how a single term may have different meanings. And because of these different meanings, sometimes a big misunderstanding has happened here. Some Muslim theologians have misunderstood the term Jabr. So they thought any sort of necessity is equal to Jabr or determinism. So they went to the position to say, they took the position that there is no necessary relation between cause and effect. There is no necessary relation between a human being and his voluntary acts. Because they thought, if they say that there is a necessary relation, so it means that we are determined. So either, in their view, either we must deny necessary relation between cause and effect, between us and our voluntary acts, or we must deny freedom of our will. They couldn't match these two together. So in their view, if I am doing something and I am responsible for what I am doing, so there must be no necessary relation between me and my act. And you know that philosophically this is not acceptable, because this leads to the chance. If there is a cause and the cause is completed, so certainly the effect must come out. Of course, part of the perfect or complete cause are illatu tamma in our own voluntary actions is our free will. But when everything is completed, every requirements are fulfilled, is fulfilled, and we have our decision made, we have our determination, so when the cause is completed, certainly and necessary the effect must be there. This is why philosophers believe that there is a necessary relation between cause and effect. Inshallah, we will discuss this later. But some theologians, because they thought that Jabr means necessity, so they said there is no necessary relation between us and our voluntary acts. Among Western physicists, modern physicists, also some misunderstanding has happened. So some of them have said that because there is no possibility of determining movements of phenomena of microphysics, so there is no causality there. So when you go into the center of the nuclear particles. If you go inside the seed of the atom, or even go further, when you reach very, very, very small particles of a thing, a being, then they say no longer the causality works. No longer our ordinary philosophical explanation of the events works. That is an area in which we cannot at all explain why this happens after that. And some people who have been religious and they were interested in finding some arguments to support the idea of free will, they said, okay, this is good. We can use this idea of these physicists to say that whenever there is freedom, there is no causality. And this is one example offered by these physicists. But someone who is equipped with philosophy, who is aware of philosophy, knows that there can be no effect without a complete cause being there. You may not be able to guess what comes second, what comes next. You may not be able to identify what is the complete cause. But according to our principles, we know in general whether we are able to find the details in this particular case or not. But we know in general that no contingent being can come into existence without its complete cause being there. Anyway, this was just to give you an idea that how a single term like Jabr may be used in different meanings, and it may cause some misunderstanding and confusion. It may be taken as equal to necessity, and then because we reject Jabr in one sense, we may think that necessity, which is another sense of Jabr, is also something wrong and must be negated. Although it took us lots of time, and the author, you know, has spent 2-3 pages about this, but this was very important at the beginning of our study of philosophy, because we have always remember that if we don't first of all clarify the concepts involved, especially in a sophisticated and complicated science like philosophy, we may always make mistakes and suffer illusions. Okay, now let's go back to our discussion about technical meanings of the term philosophy and technical meanings of the term science or scientific philosophy. Let's first start with science, which is very easy to understand, and then we discuss about philosophy. The term science, or the term ilm in Arabic and many other languages like Farsi, have different meanings. Sometimes we use ilm, we use knowledge or science, to refer to something which is known for sure, something which is certainly known. We have no doubt about it. This is a very general usage of the term. So anything that you know is called ilm. But sometimes we use the term just to refer to a set of propositions which are put in a system. So you have a set of systematized propositions, maybe general propositions, or maybe individual and particular propositions. For example, physics in this sense is a science, is ilm. Chemistry is a science, is ilm, a discipline. History also is a science. Because although the propositions in the history are particular and individual, you say this person in that period did that, or for example, this empire collapsed, or for example, was destroyed, and so on and so forth, all are individual and not universal propositions, but still this is a discipline, a system, which is made from several propositions that all are related to each other and they have the same function of clarifying certain subject matter. So this is also another meaning of the term ilm. Sometimes it becomes more limited. So we are not saying anything which is certain is ilm, or anything which is certain and is a set of propositions related to each other. No, we make it even more limited. And that is a set of propositions which are related to each other and are universal. So they can be applied to as many individuals as possible, as many instances as possible, as many cases as possible. For example, if I say something as a proposition in physics, it applies to all cases. If I say, for example, that whenever you have, for example, an external force, and this force wants to move the object in a particular direction, there is an inertia, there is a resistance. So this applies to all objects. Or when we say that two, for example, opposing forces, they neutralize each other if they are equal, or if they are not equal, the one who is greater gets reduced. These are universal propositions. So this is another meaning of the term science. And sometimes when we say universal propositions, we make it even more limited, and we say that we do not mean by science, we do not want to include under science, according to this usage, which is more limited, except those universal propositions which belong to the realities, real sciences, not conventionals. For example, grammar, vocabulary, rhetoric, many of disciplines which relate to the things that we ourselves decide, we ourselves make, like traffic, for example, rules, or many other conventional rules, these are not included under science. So sometimes it is applied to all universal propositions which are made as a system, as a discipline, and sometimes more limited, and it's applicable only to the non-conventional ones. And sometimes it becomes more limited, and indeed the most limited, and that is something which is very common in the West after positivism, and unfortunately this causes sometimes some misunderstanding, and that is to limit science only to scientific discoveries which are based on experimentation, positive sciences. So in this sense, religious sciences, philosophical sciences are not considered as science. Okay, you may say, no problem. This is a special usage of the term and it makes no significance. You may call anything you like science. As long as people understand what you mean by science, it's okay. You may have your own terminology. You may say that from tomorrow I call, for example, science anything which has these qualities. Okay, we say, no problem. Is a personal choice. This person, this writer, whenever he used this term, he means this. But unfortunately, the problem is that whenever people limit science to only the positive sciences, experimental sciences, there is a great possibility for illusions, for mistakes. And that is to say, okay, we are after science. Nothing other than science exists. Other than science means fiction, means mistakes, means fallacies. So because metaphysics, because theology are not experimental, so these are fictions. These are meaningless. This is the problem. So you must know that in which sense you are using the term science and what is the opposite of this meaning. This is very important and very profound issue. So if you look at the screen, please, you would see that in the book these different meanings of the science are explained. And because I want to make sure that you have fully understood, I want to explain it again, just to review. The first meaning we discussed is that certain belief corresponding to reality. So any fact that you know, anything that you know, for example, you know that today is Tuesday. This is also ilm, which is the opposite of simple and compound ignorance. We mean by simple ignorance the position of mind when doesn't know something. But we mean by compound ignorance when we think that we know but we are mistaken. So I think that I know, but indeed I don't know. This is worse than simple ignorance. But because when you don't know and you know that you don't know, so you can try to acquire knowledge. But when you don't know, but you think that you know, then you never try to acquire knowledge. Okay. So this is the first sense of science. Then we have the second meaning, the second sense, in which you have a discipline, the set of propositions considered to be relevant to one another. Even if the propositions are singular and specific, so they have individual subject matters in their propositions. Like, for example, history, like a special Islamic science of Ar-Rajal, which is to study the narrationists and transmitters of hadith. So these are also considered as ilm. So we say history is a science. But the third sense is, okay, the set of universal propositions which are considered, this is very important, please pay attention to this third. Here, we want to limit the meaning of the term science to the extent that we exclude history or, for example, ilm al-rajal and similar disciplines. So here you have a set of universal propositions. In the second meaning was either universal or singular and specific, particular. But here you have just universal proposition. So if you say, for example, that the king so-and-so conquered so-and-so land in so-and-so date, this is not science in the third sense. It is a piece of science, a piece of scientific proposition in the second sense, but not in the third sense. But there is also another possibility to make it even more limited. Please look at the fourth. Please look at the screen. Okay. The set of universal, so this is like the third universal, but the difference is that here we exclude conventional propositions. So in the third sense, grammar was included, but in the fourth sense, grammar is not considered as a science. So the science includes all the theoretical and practical sciences, including theology and metaphysics, but it does not apply to singular, because we have excluded singular before, and conventional, which we have just excluded. And finally, the fifth is the set of real propositions which can be justified by sense experiences. This is the sense, this is the meaning of science according to the positive philosophers. And this is the very sense in which the positivists employ the term, and on this basis the non-empirical sciences and learning are not considered to be ilm or science. So they say metaphysics is not a science, theology is not a science. Okay, having said that, now let's see what are different meanings of the term philosophy. Very quickly, the term philosophy also has different usage, different meanings. For example, sometimes, as you remember, like for example the time of Socrates, it was used to include all different disciplines which are related to the real world. Maybe natural sciences, maybe mathematics, music, maybe economics, maybe politics, maybe ethics, maybe theology, all were included under the term philosophy. The only exception was the conventional sciences, like grammar, like vocabulary, like any other thing which we ourselves create. It's not to discover the reality, it's not to explore the world outside. This is something that we create and we agree among ourselves. This is what we call it conventional. Then, the second sense of philosophy which was adopted in medieval ages by the scholastic philosophers was even expanded more and more to the extent that it included conventional sciences. So this was not limited, this was expanded. So they meant by philosophy all those sciences that we mentioned before, along with conventional sciences like grammar, like rhetorics, vocabulary, and so on. This was the second sense. The third sense of philosophy, which was introduced to mankind, especially to the people in the West, after the appearance and emergence of positivism, was a limited sense of philosophy. When they said that we must distinguish between philosophy and science, and they meant by science experimental sciences. So philosophy was limited to non-experimental sciences. So among those different branches of philosophy that we mentioned before, some were excluded. So natural sciences were no longer part of philosophy. Economics was no longer part of philosophy. Many things were excluded, so philosophy was limited, was made small. The fourth sense of philosophy was even more limited, and it was only exclusively used for metaphysics and theology. Even mathematics was excluded, and many other things were excluded, and the only thing remained under philosophy was metaphysics and theology. And sometimes even theology is used separately. So we have four senses for philosophy. One, a general usage which was used by Socrates and other Greek philosophers and also by Muslim philosophers, and that is to include theoretical sciences and practical sciences which are aiming at discovering the real world. The second usage, which was used by scholastic philosophers, was to include even conventional disciplines and sciences. So it was expansion. The third, which was influenced by positivism, was to limit the term philosophy, the concept of philosophy, into non-experimental sciences. And finally, a much more limited usage is to use philosophy only for metaphysics and for theology. Okay, the last thing which I should mention quickly and finish is that some people also use a special term, and that is scientific philosophy. And very quickly, we want to clarify the meaning of scientific philosophy and finish this lesson. There have been three different senses in which the term scientific philosophy has been used. When he used his idea about positive sciences, he wrote multiple of volumes on different sciences. For example, three volumes on sociology. And he used many philosophical ideas, many non-experimental ideas, to prove that philosophy doesn't, which was used by Marxists. So Karl Marx and his followers and those sympathetic to them, they call their philosophy scientific philosophy because they feel, they say, they claim, is based on findings of sciences, and dialectic logic is based on findings of modern sciences. So they always were proud of being able to give some scientific examples. Whether it worked or not, this is something else, because we believe that you cannot prove 2-3 examples and then generalizing them. But anyway, they called their philosophy scientific philosophy in this sense. Scientific philosophy is used for methodology of sciences, because you know that each methodology, and we should know the general methodology for scientific studies, and also methodology of each particular discipline. And this is also called scientific philosophy. Anyway, whether really you can have a combination of science and philosophy, and what is the relation between science and philosophy?